Simon Singh is our guest on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are pleased to have you with us. I was very struck as I read the code book by this narrative of which Bill is speaking when he talks about Per Bach, who is a physicist, and you speak as you talk about these human encounters. The stories you tell over millennia, whether you're talking about the breaking of the effectively the code of linear B that happens in the Mediterranean cultures, if you're talking about hieroglyphics, which I have a great fondness, but the humanness of all this, there is a peculiar, a fascinating, a charming cross that is between the purity of this elaborate symbol system that we call mathematics, and just the down and dirty, who's going to lose their head, of storytelling. They seem inseparable. Does this speak to your art and science notion?
If I'm going to talk about science, to anybody in any situation, I have to talk about the scientists. When scientists write papers, they disassociate themselves from what they're saying. So the beaker is heated. They don't say, I went into the laboratory, it was a beautiful day, and the flames lapped up the side of the beaker. And
if they do, they get thrown out
exactly.
of the academy.
So they don't get published.
That's right. But it could be. There is an interesting story there. The moments of brilliance. You know, we were talking about Clifford Cox earlier. RSA was invented by GCHQ, and somebody did the maths, and this is how the maths works. I find it interesting that the person who discovered it in Britain was young, was 23, who didn't know what they weren't supposed to be able to do, who approached the idea fresh, who had security limitations on what they could write down on paper, who then had to endure 25 years of anonymity because their work was classified, because they then had to watch other people rediscover it and get the credit. All of those things to me are interesting, and the important thing to know is not to forget the science, and I relish trying to explain the science as well. But there's no need for it to be an either or.
I ask Alan Guth,
who is an astrophysicist,
who's given credit for inflation theory, how the early universe was formed, why math works. Because a lot of his work was based on just extraordinary mathematics, things that are almost as arcane as some of the stuff we used to solve Fermat's last theorem. And he didn't quite shrug. But basically said, I don't know. It does. It seems to. You've been working back and forth, and you're obviously enchanted by both science and mathematics and care about it. Have you formed, or have any of the people you've talked with formed any notion of what it is about the universe we inhabit that connects physical reality to this essential abstraction that is numbers and the ability to manipulate numbers?
I'm
25 or few words.
Well, I'll just quote somebody else. That's kind of a standard way to get out of these problems. I think it was something like Einstein who said that the most incomprehensible thing about our universe is that it is comprehensible. And it's comprehensible because we can measure it, we can compare it, we can put numbers to things. The law of gravity isn't just higgledy-piggledy, it's a strict inverse square law.
But higgledy-piggledy is a technical term.
That's right.
Hard to quantify, but...
I'm very weak when it comes to the philosophy of science. I've never really... my philosophy stops at whether or not I think we're just playing with models, or whether we're taking a formalist approach to science. And I kind of think that the models we build of the universe are actually what the universe is. The world is made of these things called quarks. Now, we might not quite know what these things are, but they're not just convenient notions for helping us do other calculations. They are real entities.
In that context, talking with Alan Guth and talking with Brian Greene, and other lots of other people, but
Brian Greene's a physicist.
String theory, super string theory. Again, very arcane mathematics. And what is interesting, and I think both of their cases, if my recollection is correct, they both ended up reaching out into branches of mathematics to find tools that no one had ever, as you were saying early on, a lot of what is developed is just developed because it can be developed logically. But that, you know, years later, centuries later, somebody will reach back and use mathematics that was created for no particular reason, with no application in mind, other than the mathematics of it, and find an application in the physical world, which to me is striking. It's
almost as if the theory is ahead of the fact. Is that right?
That's perfectly plausible.
Yeah, it goes in both directions. I mean, in the case of today's modern encryption systems, all the maths has been there for centuries, but it was only put together 20, 30 years ago. So why didn't we solve this problem 200 years ago? Essentially because it wasn't such a big problem. It's only with the information revolution and satellites that encryption became, the key distribution aspect of it, became a real nightmare. And that's why people, I think, suddenly said, well, we have to try the impossible.
And now we have necessity that is the engine for, if not
that's
the
right.
mother of invention.
And lo and behold, all the tools are here. Sometimes, though, you desperately want to solve a problem and the ideas don't exist. And then you just have to wait until one. And that's the thing with Fermat's Last Theorem. With Fermat's Last Theorem, for 350 years, everybody does want to solve this problem. But it's only when all the mechanisms are provided that someone like Andrew Wiles can come along and put them all together and say, now is the time.
I don't want to let this time pass without talking about something really arcane, which is quantum cryptography and the both sides of that, the ability to break codes using quantum computers, and then the ability to create what appears to be an unbreakable code using quantum mechanics.
Let me just add, this comes at the end of the book. that when you're
talking
about
it's still great stuff. The
code book, this is way out stuff. This quantum computer is pretty way out, but quantum, oh, and Bill's giving me the old, oh, it's not, look.
No, 6 months.
and the theories are there. Isn't this part of the time in which we live, that things happen so fast, and in 6 months some big something may have happened, that all this just becomes, oh yeah.
Yeah, well, the whole history of codes is a battle between code makers and code breakers. I make a code, I use it for a year, somebody then breaks it, I have to come up with a better code. Somebody breaks that, I have to come up with a machine encryption system. Somebody breaks that, I have to come up with a computer encryption system, and so on and so on. So today, we're in a situation where the code makers are ahead. We have very good codes, no one can break them. We're waiting for that moment when somebody does break them. One way you could break today's codes is with a quantum computer. With a traditional computer, when you solve a problem, you have to test lots and lots of numbers sometimes. You have to say, well, is one a solution? No. Is two a solution? Is three a solution? And one by one, you have to check all the numbers, and that's very slow. If you've got trillions and trillions of numbers, it takes a long time doing it one by one. In quantum physics, and that's what a quantum computer exploits. In quantum physics, there is this notion that something can be in two states at the same time. So the example that people use is Schrodinger's cat. Schrodinger was a physics professor. He said, imagine you have a cat, you put a cat in a box, close the lid, there's a poison tablet in the box, and you don't know whether the cat has swallowed the tablet or not. Is the cat dead or alive? Traditionally, you kind of say, well, we don't know. It is either dead or alive, and the longer we wait, the more probable it is that it's dead, but it is either dead or alive. You open the box and it's still alive. Quantum physics says, no, that's not really what happens. What really happens is you close the lid, and the cat is not dead or alive, it's dead and alive at the same time, in a superposition of states. There's a simultaneous existence of two cats. And when you open the box, and as the time goes by, the dead cat begins to be more dominant than the living cat, because it's more likely. But they both exist. You open the lid, And in fact, it turns out that the cat is alive, so the living cat becomes a reality and the dead cat vanishes. But it's this simultaneous existence of two cats in quantum physics, which is the crucial notion here. Because with a quantum computer, you don't test one number and then the next and then the next. You test all the numbers simultaneously. And so simultaneously, you can check every number. All the numbers that are wrong vanish. The number that's right becomes a reality.
Historically, I think most of us, would, to the extent we came across this strange cat, tended today to think of it as Alice in Wonderland, but think of it as an analogy. And what is in some senses surprising is that what people are now saying is this is not an analogy. This is in fact how the universe is, or this is the most plausible explanation that we can come up with.
And you get to answer that when we come back in just a moment. This is Simon Singh with Bill Russell. I'm watching. I'm Paula. We'll be back in just a minute.